Welcome to your personalized deep dive. Today, we're going deep on this document that's making waves, Mandate for Leadership, the Conservative Promise.
Right.
It's like, imagine a playbook for how a potential conservative administration might shake things up in 2025.
Right.
And you know what?
Right.
This isn't just vague campaign talk. This gets into the nuts and bolts of running the entire government.
Well, what's fascinating is that this isn't entirely new. It's actually modeled after a similar document from the Reagan era, which had a surprising impact on policy.
Wait, seriously?
Yeah.
Like they dusted off a vintage playbook.
Exactly.
Right.
The original Mandate for Leadership, it came out in 1981,
Okay.
the same month Reagan took office.
No kidding.
And get this, over 60% of its recommendations actually became policy.
Wow.
This new version is aiming for that same level of influence, but for the challenges America faces, today.
So they're not just talking the talk, they're aiming to walk the walk.
Right.
But what are some of the like big picture shifts they're proposing?
Well, one of the most striking aspects is the emphasis on the American family.
Okay.
The document argues that strengthening families is key to tackling a whole host of societal issues.
Okay, but how do they propose to actually do that?
Yeah.
Family values, a pretty common campaign slogan,
Right.
but this document seems to go further.
You're right. It's not just rhetoric.
Yeah.
They propose leveraging federal power, especially through changes to the tax code,
Okay.
to encourage family formation and what they call family cohesion.
Okay, so less taxes for families, more support for
Yay.
traditional family structures. That sounds like a
Yeah,
big shift in priorities.
it is.
But this document also talks about taking on the federal bureaucracy, even firing quote-unquote unfirable bureaucrats.
Right.
Is that even possible?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
It is.
The document lays out strategies for a potential conservative president to assert more control over the vast federal bureaucracy. They want to
Sure.
streamline agencies, eliminate waste, and make the government more efficient.
It sounds like they're aiming for a leaner, meaner government. But wouldn't that mean
Yeah.
a lot of people losing their jobs?
Potentially, yes. They talk about using attrition,
Okay.
meaning not replacing people who leave to, shrink the federal workforce.
Yeah.
And they specifically want to target offices they see as unnecessary or wasteful.
Okay. So less government, less spending. That's a pretty classic conservative approach.
Yeah.
But this document doesn't just stop at broad strokes, right?
No.
It gets into the weeds of specific positions within the White House. It's like they're writing a job description for the next president's team. What stands out to you?
Well, they really hammer home the point that, quote, personnel is policy.
Right.
They dive deep into the roles of key positions, like the chief of staff, emphasizing the need for someone who's not only competent, but also fiercely loyal and can drive the president's agenda forward.
So, no room for dissent or disagreement within the White House.
Well, they seem to be emphasizing unity and a clear chain of command. They even suggest having an organizational chart that clearly defines everyone's roles and responsibilities.
Feels like they're trying to create a well-oiled machine
Yeah.
that operates with military precision. What about the legal team?
Well, they spend a lot of time on the White House counsel highlighting the need for lawyers who aren't just cautious, but actively committed to
Okay.
advancing the president's agenda within the bounds of the law.
Gotcha.
They want lawyers who are creative problem solvers, not just roadblocks.
So they're looking for legal minds who can find ways to make things happen, not just tell the president what they can't do.
Right.
What about other key positions?
Another interesting one is the staff secretary. It might
Okay.
sound obscure, but
Yeah.
this person is essentially the gatekeeper of information flowing to the president's desk.
Okay.
Okay, the document stresses the need for someone who can ensure that the president sees only what's aligned with their priorities.
So the staff secretary can shape what the president sees
Yeah.
and potentially influence their decisions.
Yeah.
That's a lot of power for one person.
It is. And they also emphasize the importance of the Office of Presidential Personnel, the folks who handle appointments.
Right.
They see this as crucial for filling the government with individuals who are not just qualified,
Right.
but ideologically aligned with the conservative agenda.
It's like they're building an army of loyalists ready to implement their vision across every branch of government What about national security? That's usually a big focus for conservatives.
Absolutely. And this document is very clear.
Yeah.
China is public enemy number one.
Whoa.
They call for making China the central focus of U.S. defense planning,
okay.
arguing that the Chinese Communist Party poses the most significant threat to America's global standing.
So a major shift from the war on terror to a new kind of great power competition. What does that mean for everyday Americans?
Well, for one thing, it means a bigger military budget. They call for modernizing and expanding the U.S. nuclear arsenal to deter China, which would be a very expensive undertaking.
That sounds like a major escalation.
It is. And they also emphasize the need for allies to share more of the burden of defense spending.
Oh,
they argue that the U.S. can't shoulder the responsibility alone, so they're calling for more contributions from NATO and other allies.
So a tougher stance on China, a bigger military, and more pressure on allies to chip in. That's a pretty hawkish foreign policy agenda.
Gosh.
But what about the military itself? They propose some pretty significant changes there too, right?
They do. They call for a return to a focus on warfighting, arguing that the military has become too bogged down in what they call social experimentation. They want to streamline the military, eliminate distractions, and make it more lethal and efficient.
So less focus on things like diversity and inclusion, and more on preparing for a potential conflict with China. What are some of the specific changes they propose?
Well, they recommend increasing the Air Force budget to modernize its fleet.
Okay.
Exploring the creation of a Space Force Academy to develop future leaders in space warfare.
Yeah.
And revamping intelligence agencies to focus specifically on the threat from China.
So a real overhaul of the military's structure and priorities.
Yeah. They even suggest eliminating certain intelligence obligations, like conducting civilian security clearances, arguing that these distract from the core mission of national defense. It's all about focusing resources and energy on what they see as the most pressing threat, China.
Okay, so that's a glimpse into their vision for the military and foreign policy. But what about domestic policy? Where do they propose to make cuts, and what do they want to shake up on the home front?
Well, one agency that gets a lot of attention is the Department of Homeland Security.
DHS, agency created after 9/11 to protect the country from terrorism. What do they have in mind for that?
They argue that DHS has become bloated and bureaucratic.
Okay.
And they want to streamline it by shifting more responsibility to the private sector.
Right.
They specifically call for privatizing TSA screening and FEMA's National Flood Insurance Program.
Okay.
They even want to eliminate most of DHS's grant programs.
Wow, that's a pretty dramatic restructuring. Privatization is a classic conservative solution, but this goes even further than that.
Yeah.
What about immigration? That's always a hot-button issue.
They have a lot to say about immigration.
Right.
And their approach is very much about stricter enforcement and tighter controls. They want to transform U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, or USCIS, back into what they call a screening and vetting agency focused on national security and public safety.
So a crackdown on illegal immigration and a more rigorous vetting process for those seeking to enter the country legally. What does that look like in practice?
Well, they advocate for limiting prosecutorial discretion in immigration enforcement, meaning less flexibility for immigration officials to prioritize certain cases over others. They also propose mandating E-Verify for all government contractors to prevent the hiring of undocumented workers. They want to increase detention space for those apprehended at the border.
Okay.
And eliminate the use of alternatives to detention like ankle bracelets, except in rare cases.
Sounds like they're really trying to make it much harder to live in the U.S. illegally.
They are. And their proposals for Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, are even more controversial.
ICE has become pretty notorious for its enforcement actions.
Yeah.
Detention centers. What changes do they propose?
They recommend making it easier for ICE officers to enter workplaces to apprehend undocumented workers, rescinding memos that limit ICE's enforcement authority, including those that establish sensitive zones where enforcement is discouraged. They want to give USCIS access to national security and law enforcement databases to enhance its vetting capabilities.
So they're basically proposing to unleash ICE and give them more power to go after undocumented immigrants.
It certainly seems that way. They even suggest issuing a joint memo on how to use so-called Blackie's warrants, which essentially allow immigration officers to enter workplaces without a judicial warrant.
Blackie's warrants. That sounds pretty ominous.
Yeah.
What are those exactly?
Well, they're named after a Supreme Court case from the 1970s that upheld the right of immigration officers to enter workplaces to search for undocumented workers.
Okay.
These warrants have been controversial because they allow for warrantless searches, which some argue violates the Fourth Amendment's protection against unreasonable searches and seizures.
So they're basically proposing to revive a controversial practice that allows for more aggressive worksite raids.
Right.
What about FEMA? They mentioned some specific ideas for that agency too, right?
Yes, they argue that FEMA is overtasked and overcompensates for a lack of preparedness at the state and local levels. They claim that the agency is regularly in debt and unprepared for truly catastrophic disasters.
So they see FEMA as inefficient and too reliant on federal funding. What do they propose instead?
They call for shifting more responsibility for disaster preparedness and response back to states and localities, arguing for a more decentralized approach.
Okay.
They want FEMA to focus on large-scale, truly catastrophic events rather than smaller, more localized incidents.
So less federal involvement and more reliance on local authorities to handle disasters. That seems to be a recurring theme here.
Yeah.
What specific changes do they propose for FEMA?
One major recommendation is to reform FEMA's emergency spending to shift more of the costs to states and localities.
Okay.
They also suggest consolidating and reforming DHS's external communications function, merging the Office of Partnership and Engagement into the Office of Public Affairs to streamline operations and reduce the number of offices reporting directly to the secretary.
So more efficiency and less bureaucracy.
Right.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah.
It's like they're trying to apply the same principles of limited government and fiscal responsibility to every agency, from DHS to FEMA.
Yeah.
But their vision doesn't stop at our borders, right?
Yeah.
They have some pretty sweeping ideas for foreign policy, too.
They do. And their approach to the State Department is particularly interesting.
The State Department. That's all about diplomacy and foreign policy, right?
Yeah.
What's their take on that?
Well, they argue that the State Department has become too large and bureaucratic, and they propose some major changes to make it more effective in advancing American interests abroad. They even suggest that a new president should consider placing appointees in key State Department roles immediately, even before they're confirmed by the Senate, to ensure there's no delay in implementing their agenda.
Wow. That's pretty aggressive. Aren't they worried about potential pushback from the Senate?
Well, they seem to be anticipating that. They argue that this is necessary to prevent the Senate from using delaying tactics to, you know, obstruct the president's nominees.
So they're not afraid of a little confrontation?
Yeah.
What are some of their specific foreign policy goals?
Well, as we mentioned earlier, they're very hawkish on China. They advocate for taking a much tougher stance on China, using the State Department and its resources to counter Chinese influence globally. They even propose drafting a new Article X for China, a kind of guiding document that outlines a more confrontational approach to dealing with the Chinese Communist Party.
They're really calling for a major shift in U.S. foreign policy, moving away from diplomacy and engagement and towards a more confrontational approach. What about Iran? That's been another longstanding foreign policy challenge.
They call for preventing Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons and blocking its ambitions in the region. They recommend reinstating and expanding the Trump-era sanctions, providing more security assistance to regional allies, and even supporting the Iranian people in their fight against the regime.
So a multi-pronged approach to containing Iran, using both hard power and soft power. What about Israel? The U.S. has a long-standing alliance with Israel.
They reiterate their strong support for Israel, suggests ensuring that Israel has the military means and political support to defend itself against Iran and its proxies. They also take a critical stance on international organizations, arguing that the U.S. should only participate in those that promote American interests. If an organization doesn't serve American interests, they suggest withdrawing from it altogether.
So a very America-first approach to foreign policy, prioritizing American interests above all else. What about the vast U.S. intelligence community? That's a complex network of agencies. With the CIA being the most well-known, what's their vision for the intelligence community?
They call for using the IC more aggressively to counter adversaries like China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea,
yeah.
while also maintaining the tools needed to fight terrorism.
Okay.
They argue for streamlining the IC,
right.
removing redundancies, and eliminating mission creep to ensure that it's focused on providing the president with objective and actionable intelligence.
So they want to make the IC more efficient
yeah.
and aligned with their foreign policy goals.
Yeah.
What about the CIA specifically? What changes do they propose for America's most famous spy agency?
Well, they recommend a major overhaul of the CIA's personnel system, broadening recruitment, expediting the onboarding process, and shifting resources away from headquarters positions.
Sounds like they're trying to make the CIA less bureaucratic,
yeah,
more agile.
Exactly. They suggest moving certain directorates like support and science and technology out of the DC area, and even opening campuses outside of Washington where analysts and other experts could work remotely.
So they're talking about geographically dispersing the CIA,
right,
which is pretty unconventional.
It is. They also advocate for recruiting more private sector experts directly into senior positions, arguing that the CIA needs to be more open to outside talent.
Mm.
They even suggest using buyouts, forced rotations, and up or out personnel policies to shake things up and bring in fresh blood.
Sounds like a pretty major shakeup of the CIA's culture.
It is. They want a CIA that's more nimble, more focused, and more results-oriented. And this focus on confronting China extends to the National Counterintelligence and Security Center, or NCSC.
What's the role of NCSC? I have to admit, I'm not that familiar with all the different intelligence agencies.
NCSC is responsible for coordinating counterintelligence activities across the government, protecting the U.S. from foreign espionage.
So they're the ones who catch spies.
Right. But the document argues that NCSC needs to adapt to the changing nature of espionage, which is no longer just about traditional, you know, spy versus spy threats.
What are some of the new challenges they highlight?
They point to the rise of China, arguing that Chinese espionage extends beyond the government to target technology, economics, supply chains, academia, and even state and local governments.
So a much broader and more sophisticated threat than in the past.
Exactly. They also emphasize the importance of cybersecurity,
right,
arguing that NCSC needs to be more proactive in defending U.S. networks from cyber attacks.
Cybersecurity has become a huge issue with high-profile hacks happening all the time.
And the document calls for a more aggressive approach to sharing cyber threat intelligence, suggesting an obligation to share policy that would make it easier to disseminate information about cyber threats to the public and private sector within 48 hours of collection, similar to how counterterrorism intelligence has been handled for years.
So they're drawing a parallel between cyber threats and terrorism, arguing that we need to be just as aggressive in defending against them. What about other agencies involved in projecting American influence abroad, like the U.S. Agency for Global Media or USAGM?
Yes, USAGM oversees things like Voice of America and Radio Free Europe.
Those are the government-funded broadcasters that transmit news and information around the world.
Exactly. The document is highly critical of USAGM, arguing that it's failing to fulfill its mission of promoting freedom and democracy.
That's a pretty strong indictment. What's their evidence for that claim?
Well, they argue that USAGM is
mismanaged,
disorganized, and ineffective, with a lot of waste and redundancy. They claim that instead of providing accurate and reliable news, the agency has become a platform for leftist ideology and even anti-American sentiment.
So they see it as a tool of the left rather than a neutral voice for American values. What do they propose doing about it?
Yeah. Well, they recommend a thorough house cleaning of USAGM, removing those who they believe are responsible for its current state and replacing them with individuals committed to their conservative vision. They also call for a much clearer definition of USAGM's mission.
Got it.
And more oversight to ensure that it's being fulfilled.
So less autonomy for USAGM and more control from the administration. What about USAITI? That's the U.S. Agency for International Development, which provides foreign aid around the world.
They argue that USAID has become a bloated bureaucracy that's more interested in perpetuating itself than in actually helping people. They claim that USAID's programs are often incoherent, with funding being directed towards politically motivated projects rather than genuine development needs.
So they see a lot of waste and ideological bias in how USAID operates.
They do. They call for a major overhaul of the agency's structure and priorities, with less money going to the quote-unquote aid industrial complex, and more focus on what they see as real development needs.
Okay, so a more streamlined and less politically driven approach to foreign aid.
Mm.
What about the Department of Health and Human Services, or HHS? That's a massive agency that oversees a wide range of health programs. What's their vision for HHS?
Well, they're pretty critical of HHS, particularly the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC. They argue that the CDC has lost the public's trust due to its handling of the COVID-19 pandemic.
The CDC has faced a lot of criticism for its pandemic response.
It has. And this document doesn't hold back, calling the CDC perhaps the most incompetent and arrogant agency in the federal government.
Wow, that's harsh.
They criticize the CDC for its reliance on what they call observational studies and for its support of policies like mask mandates and lockdowns, which they view as ineffective and harmful.
So they're aligning themselves with those who opposed many of the public health measures implemented during the pandemic.
Right. They argue that future public health responses need to be more transparent, scientifically rigorous, and respectful of individual liberties.
So less government intervention and more personal freedom when it comes to health decisions.
Yeah.
What about the National Institutes of Health, or NIH? That's the agency that funds a lot of medical research.
They're also critical of the NIH, particularly for its funding of research on aborted fetal tissue and gain-of-function research on viruses.
Those are highly controversial areas of research.
They are. And the document argues that NIH's funding priorities are misaligned and reflect a disregard for ethical considerations.
Right.
They also criticize Anthony Fauci, the former director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, for his ties to the pharmaceutical industry, specifically his role in the development of the Moderna COVID-19 vaccine.
Fauci has become a very polarizing figure.
He has, and this document clearly aligns itself with those who are critical of his role in the pandemic response.
So a major shakeup of the public health bureaucracy is on their agenda.
Yeah.
What about healthcare more broadly, particularly programs like Medicare and Medicaid?
Well, they argue that these programs have become too expensive and bureaucratic, and they call for significant reforms to make them more sustainable and efficient.
Medicare and Medicaid are massive government programs that provide healthcare coverage to millions of Americans. What specific reforms do they propose?
For Medicare, they suggest reducing the regulatory burden on private Medicare Advantage plans, arguing that this would increase competition and lower costs.
Gotcha.
They also advocate for revising the drug pricing provisions in Medicare Part D to make it easier for hospitals to negotiate lower prices for prescription drugs.
Put more reliance on the private sector and less government regulation of drug prices.
Yeah.
What about Medicaid?
For Medicaid, they call for giving states more flexibility in how they manage their Medicaid programs, potentially reducing costs.
That's a longstanding conservative goal.
It is. They also want to reform how hospitals are reimbursed under Medicaid, arguing that the current system is unfair to states with lower federal spending.
Right.
They suggest moving towards a system that's more equitable and reflects the actual costs of care.
So a major restructuring of Medicaid financing. Their vision for HHS also includes some controversial social policies.
You're right. They're strongly pro-life.
Okay.
And they want to see HHS take a much more active role in restricting abortion access.
Abortion is one of the most divisive issues in American politics. What specific policies do they propose?
They specifically call for withdrawing Medicaid funding from Planned Parenthood. They also want to prohibit HHS from using Title X family planning funds to support organizations that provide abortions.
Title X is a federal program that provides funding for family planning services.
Right.
But current regulations prevent those funds from being used for abortions.
Right. But they argue that even indirect funding of abortion providers is unacceptable.
Got it.
They want to ensure that no taxpayer dollars go towards supporting abortion in any way.
So a very hardline stance on abortion. What else is on their social policy agenda?
Well, they also want to see HHS promote what they call traditional family structures.
What does that mean in practice?
They criticize HHS for promoting what they see as a sexual liberation agenda.
Okay.
And they want to see a shift towards policies that encourage marriage and abstinence.
So a more socially conservative approach to public health.
Yes. And this extends to how they view gender identity.
That's become a very contentious issue in recent years.
It has. The document is highly critical of what it calls gender ideology.
Right.
And they want to see HHS take a much more skeptical approach to transgender health care, particularly for minors.
What does that mean in terms of policy?
They advocate for prohibiting federal funding for gender transition surgeries for minors.
Okay.
And they want to see HHS promote research.
Right.
That questions the effectiveness of gender-affirming care. So they're basically trying to roll back the gains made by the transgender community in recent years.
It's definitely a rollback of those policies. They argue that children are too young to make decisions about their gender identity and that these decisions should be left to parents.
So a very traditional view of gender roles.
Right.
And parental authority.
Right.
But their vision for a more conservative America doesn't end there, does it?
Yeah.
They also have some pretty specific ideas about how to reform the Department of Agriculture, or USDA.
You're right. The USDA, the agency that oversees farming and food programs, is another target for reform.
What do they have in mind for that?
First and foremost, they want to see the agency refocus on its core mission of supporting American agriculture and ensuring food security. They argue that the USDA has become too focused on issues like climate change and social justice, which they see as distractions from its primary mission.
So a back-to-basics approach to agriculture. What does that mean in terms of policy?
They specifically criticize the Biden administration's focus on transforming the food system to address climate change, arguing that this will lead to higher food prices and reduced agricultural productivity. They want to see the USDA prioritize American farmers and ranchers.
Right.
And they call for policies that support domestic food production.
So less regulation and more support for American farmers.
Exactly. They also have some specific ideas about how to reform USDA programs, particularly those that provide food assistance.
Like SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which provides food stamps to low-income families.
They want to see stricter eligibility requirements for SNAP,
arguing
that the program has become too expansive and includes too many people who don't truly need assistance.
So less government spending on food assistance. What about school lunches?
Well, they also want to see a return to the original purpose of federal school meal programs, arguing that these programs have expanded too far beyond their original intent and now serve many students who don't actually need assistance.
So they want to see fewer students receiving free or reduced price meals.
They argue that it's about ensuring that the programs are focused on those who truly need them. They also propose some significant changes to how the USDA manages federal lands.
The USDA oversees vast tracts of forests and grasslands, particularly in the West. What's their vision for those lands?
They want to see a shift towards more active management of federal lands with a focus on things like timber harvesting, grazing, and energy development.
So less emphasis on conservation and more on resource extraction.
They argue that this is about promoting economic growth and reducing the risk of wildfires.
Wildfires have become a major problem in the West.
They have, and the document argues that current land management practices are contributing to the problem. They want to see more aggressive thinning of forests and prescribed burns to reduce fuel loads and prevent catastrophic fires.
So a more hands-on approach to managing federal lands. What about rural communities? Many of them have been struggling economically.
The document argues that the USDA needs to do more to support rural communities. They propose expanding access to broadband internet investing in rural infrastructure and promoting rural entrepreneurship.
So a more proactive role for the USDA in supporting rural America, but their vision for reform doesn't end with agriculture, does it? They also have some strong opinions on how to reform the Department of Education.
You're right. Education is always a hot button issue. And this document lays out a vision for education reform that's centered on empowering parents and promoting school choice.
School choice is a longstanding conservative goal.
It is. They argue that parents should have more control over their children's education and that this can be achieved through policies like school vouchers and education savings accounts.
Those are mechanisms that allow parents to use public funds to pay for private school tuition. What are the potential implications of such a dramatic shift in education policy?
Well, it would likely lead to a significant increase in the number of students attending private schools, which could have a major impact on the funding and demographics of public schools.
What about the role of the federal government in education? They seem to be advocating for a more hands-off approach.
They do. They argue that too much federal involvement has stifled innovation and led to a decline in educational quality. They specifically propose eliminating the Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights, arguing that it's become too focused on social engineering and has overstepped its bounds.
That's a pretty radical proposal, to eliminate the office responsible for enforcing civil rights in education. What would that mean for students?
Well, it's hard to say for sure, but it could potentially make it more difficult for students who experience discrimination to seek redress.
So a major shift in the balance of power in education, with less federal oversight and more control at the state and local levels. What about student loans? That's become a huge issue for many Americans.
They're critical of the current system, arguing that it's too generous and has led to colleges and universities raising tuition prices without consequence. They want to see stricter limits on federal student loans, and they advocate for making it easier for borrowers to discharge their student loan debt through bankruptcy.
That would be a major change to bankruptcy law.
They argue that it's unfair that student loan debt is treated differently from other types of debt in bankruptcy proceedings.
So a more market-based approach to student loans, with less government involvement and more personal responsibility. Okay, so that's a taste of their vision for education.
Sure.
What about the Department of Energy? They had some big plans there too, right?
Yes, they want to see a major shift in energy policy with a focus on promoting American energy dominance.
Energy independence has been a goal of many administrations.
It has, and this document argues that the U.S. has the potential to become a net energy exporter, reducing its reliance on foreign sources of energy.
What specific policies do they propose to achieve that goal?
They call for a renewed focus on traditional energy sources like oil, natural gas, and coal, arguing that these resources are essential for American energy security and economic growth.
So a rejection of the push towards renewable energy.
They see renewables as unreliable and too reliant on government subsidies. They also want to streamline the permitting process for energy projects, arguing that the current process is too cumbersome and delays the development of vital energy infrastructure.
So less red tape and faster approvals for energy projects.
Exactly. They specifically call for eliminating political and climate change considerations in the approval of liquefied natural gas exports, arguing that these considerations are irrelevant and hinder the development of American energy resources.
So a very pro-fossil fuel agenda. What about nuclear energy?
They also advocate for a renewed focus on nuclear energy, arguing that it's a safe and reliable source of clean energy that should be expanded.
Nuclear energy has been controversial due to concerns about safety and waste disposal.
They acknowledge those concerns, but argue that modern nuclear technology is safe and that the benefits of nuclear energy outweigh the risks. They also call for reforming the Department of Energy's nuclear waste disposal program, which has been plagued by delays and cost overruns.
So a more pro-nuclear stance.
Yes, and this focus on American energy dominance extends to the Arctic Circle.
The Arctic, what's the energy connection there?
The Arctic region is believed to hold vast reserves of oil and natural gas, and the document argues that the U.S. needs to be more assertive in securing its interests in the region.
So competing with countries like Russia and China for Arctic resources.
Exactly. They call for a clear definition of American strategic and economic interests in the Arctic, and they suggest that the Department of Energy should play a lead role in developing a comprehensive Arctic policy.
So a more assertive American presence in the Arctic.
Yes, and this emphasis on American dominance extends to science and technology.
Science and technology are key drivers of economic growth and national security. What's their vision for these areas?
They want to see the U.S. reclaim its position as a global leader in science and technology, arguing that this is essential for maintaining American competitiveness in the 21st century.
What are some of their specific recommendations?
They call for refocusing the Department of Energy's national laboratories on fundamental and advanced science, arguing that these labs have become too focused on applied research and commercialization.
So a return to basic science.
Yes. They argue that basic research is the foundation for future technological breakthroughs and that the U.S. needs to invest more in this area. They also call for streamlining the process of transferring technology from the labs to the private sector, arguing that the current process is too slow and bureaucratic.
So making it easier for businesses to access and commercialize cutting-edge technologies developed in government labs.
Exactly. They also emphasize the importance of protecting American intellectual property, particularly from China, which they accuse of engaging in widespread theft of American technology.
Intellectual property theft has been a major source of tension between the U.S. and China.
It has, and the document calls for a more aggressive approach to countering Chinese intellectual property theft, including through legal action, trade sanctions, and diplomatic pressure.
So a multi-pronged approach to protecting American innovation. What about the space sector?
Space is becoming increasingly important, both commercially and militarily.
It is, and the document argues that the U.S. needs to maintain its leadership in space. They call for increasing funding for NASA with a focus on human exploration of the moon and Mars.
So a return to ambitious space exploration goals.
Yes. They see space exploration as a source of national pride and inspiration, and they argue that it's essential for advancing scientific knowledge and developing new technologies. They also call for strengthening the U.S. Space Force, the newest branch of the military, to ensure American dominance in space. So a focus on both civilian and military aspects of space.
Exactly. They see space as a critical domain for the 21st century, and they want to ensure that the U.S. remains at the forefront.
Okay, so that's a taste of their vision for science, technology, and space. What about the environment? They have a reputation for being skeptical of environmental regulations.
That's true. And their vision for the Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA, is very much in line with that skepticism.
The EPA is responsible for protecting human health and the environment. What do they want to change about it?
They argue that the EPA has become too powerful and that its regulations have become too burdensome for businesses, stifling economic growth.
So a classic critique of government overreach. What specific reforms do they propose?
They call for a number of specific reforms, including limiting the EPA's use of sue and settle lawsuits, requiring the EPA to base its regulations on sound science, increasing transparency in the EPA's decision-making process, and reforming the EPA's advisory committees.
So a more transparent, accountable, and business-friendly EPA, that's the goal. They also want to see a shift in the EPA's approach to climate change.
Climate change is one of the most pressing issues facing the world today.
It is. But they're skeptical of the scientific consensus on climate change, and they argue that the EPA has overreacted to the threat. So they're downplaying the risks of climate change? Are they suggesting we just ignore it?
Not exactly. They argue that the costs of addressing climate change outweigh the benefits, and they want to see the EPA focus on more immediate environmental problems like air and water pollution.
That makes sense. Those are issues that directly impact people's health and well-being.
Right. They argue that those are more tangible and pressing issues, shifting gears a bit. They also lay out a vision for reforming the Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD.
HUD, that's the agency that deals with affordable housing and community development, right? What's their take on that?
They argue that HUD's programs have become too expensive and ineffective, often trapping people in poverty rather than helping them achieve self-sufficiency.
So they see HUD's programs as part of the problem, not the solution. That's a pretty bold claim.
It is. They argue that HUD has focused too much on providing housing subsidies without addressing the underlying causes of poverty. Instead, they call for a more market-based approach to affordable housing, arguing that the private sector can provide better and more affordable housing options than the government.
So less government involvement and more reliance on private developers. What does that look like in practice?
Well, they want to see HUD focus more on promoting work and self-sufficiency as a way to help people escape poverty, for example. They criticize HUD's housing-first approach to homelessness, which prioritizes providing housing to individuals without requiring them to address underlying issues like addiction or mental health problems.
Housing-first has been a controversial policy. I know some people argue that it's enabling homelessness, while others say it's the most compassionate and effective way to help people get off the streets.
Right. It's a complex issue with no easy answers. The document advocates for shifting away from housing first and towards programs that require individuals to participate in treatment or job training programs as a condition of receiving housing assistance.
So a tough love approach to homelessness. What about public housing? What do they propose for that?
They argue that public housing has become concentrated poverty, isolating residents from opportunities and perpetuating a cycle of dependence. They propose a number of reforms, including increasing work requirements for public housing residents, encouraging mixed-income housing developments, and expanding the use of Section 8 vouchers, which allow low-income families to rent housing in the private market.
So their overall vision for HUD is less government intervention, more private sector involvement, and a greater emphasis on personal responsibility.
Exactly. And this emphasis on empowering communities extends to how they approach the management of federal lands, particularly in the West.
The West is home to vast tracts of public lands managed by the federal government. What's their take on that?
They argue that the federal government has been too heavy-handed in its management of these lands, often ignoring the needs and interests of local communities. They propose giving states and local communities more control over federal lands, reducing the regulatory burden on businesses that operate on federal lands, and streamlining the permitting process for projects on federal lands.
So a more decentralized and business-friendly approach to managing federal lands that could have a big impact on everything from conservation efforts to energy development.
It could. And this focus on scaling back the federal government's role extends to the Department of Justice or DOJ.
The DOJ, that's the agency responsible for enforcing federal law and representing the U.S. in legal matters.
Right. They argue that the DOJ has become too politicized and has strayed from its core mission of upholding the rule of law.
The DOJ has faced accusations of bias from both sides of the political aisle. It's a powerful agency with a lot of discretion.
It is, and the document calls for a number of reforms, including appointing a new attorney general who is committed to upholding the rule of law and enforcing the law equally, regardless of political considerations. They also want to rein in the DOJ's civil rights division, which they argue has become too focused on social engineering.
That sounds like a significant shift in priorities for the DOJ. What would that mean in practice?
Well, they want to see the DOJ prioritize fighting violent crime and protecting the First Amendment rights of all Americans. They also call for reforming the federal sentencing guidelines, arguing that they are too harsh and have contributed to mass incarceration.
So a more conservative and traditional approach to law enforcement and criminal justice? What about immigration enforcement? How did that fit into their vision for the DOJ?
They want the DOJ to take a much tougher stance on illegal immigration, using its power to increase border security, enforce existing immigration laws, more rigorously crack down on sanctuary cities, and reduce legal immigration levels.
So a very hardline approach to immigration, consistent with their vision for DHS and ICEE.
Right. They see illegal immigration as a major threat to national security and American jobs, and they want to see the DOJ take a leading role in combating it.
Okay, so that's a taste of their vision for the DOJ. What about labor policy that covers things like wages, working conditions, and unions?
They argue that current labor laws are too burdensome for businesses and stifle job creation. They propose a number of reforms, including making it easier for businesses to hire and fire workers, reducing the power of unions, and reforming the National Labor Relations Board, which they argue is biased in favor of unions.
So a more business-friendly approach to labor relations. What about unemployment insurance?
They argue that the current system is too generous and discourages people from finding new jobs. They propose reducing the duration of unemployment benefits, requiring recipients to actively search for work as a condition of receiving benefits and making it more difficult for people to qualify for benefits.
So a more stringent approach to unemployment insurance with the goal of getting people back to work as quickly as possible.
Exactly. They believe that a strong economy depends on a vibrant and flexible labor market and that government intervention in the labor market should be minimized.
Okay, so less regulation, weaker unions, and a tougher approach to unemployment insurance.
Yeah.
What about trade policy? How do they propose to navigate the complex world of global trade?
Well, they argue that current trade deals are unfair to American workers and businesses, and they call for a more protectionist approach to trade with a focus on protecting American jobs and industries.
Protectionism has been criticized for leading to higher prices for consumers in trade wars.
They acknowledge those concerns, but argue that it's necessary to protect American interests in a globalized economy. They specifically criticize the World Trade Organization, or WTO, arguing that it's biased against the U.S. and has allowed China to take advantage of American businesses.
The WTO is the international organization that governs global trade. Are they seriously suggesting withdrawing from the WTO? That would be a huge deal.
They don't explicitly call for withdrawal, but they do suggest that it's an option if the WTO doesn't reform to address their concerns. They're particularly focused on confronting China on trade, accusing China of currency manipulation, dumping goods on the U.S. market at below-cost prices, stealing American intellectual property, and providing unfair subsidies to its industries.
Those are serious accusations. What do they propose doing about it?
They call for a more aggressive approach to countering Chinese trade practices, including through tariff sanctions and diplomatic pressure. They argue that it's necessary to stand up to China and protect American interests, even if it means risking a trade war.
So a more confrontational approach to China on trade potentially leading to a trade war, that sounds risky.
Mm-hmm.
What about financial regulation? They have a reputation for wanting to deregulate the financial industry.
That's true. They argue that excessive regulation has stifled innovation and economic growth in the financial sector. They want to roll back regulations put in place after the 2008 financial crisis, arguing that those regulations were too burdensome and have made it harder for businesses to access credit and grow.
So they want to loosen the reins on Wall Street. Aren't they worried about another financial crisis?
They argue that the reforms they're proposing would actually make the financial system more stable by promoting responsible lending and reducing the risk of government bailouts. Specifically, they call for repealing or revising the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act, reducing the regulatory burden on community banks, limiting the power of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and making it easier for businesses to raise capital.
So a more deregulated and business-friendly financial sector. What about the Federal Communications Commission, or SEC? The FCC regulates the telecommunications industry, which is a rapidly evolving sector with new technologies and services emerging all the time.
They argue that the FCC has become too interventionist and has stifled innovation in the telecommunications sector. They call for limiting the FCC's authority to regulate broadband internet service providers, repealing or revising net neutrality rules, and streamlining the process of allocating spectrum.
So a more hands-off approach to telecommunications regulation, with the belief that the market will sort things out.
Exactly. They believe that competition will lead to better and more affordable services for consumers.
Okay, so a more deregulated and market-oriented approach to telecommunications. What about campaign finance? That's an issue that always seems to generate a lot of debate.
Well, they argue that current campaign finance laws are too restrictive and violate the First Amendment rights of individuals and groups to participate in the political process.
Okay.
They're against limits on campaign contributions and spending. Arguing that such limits violate the First Amendment and that the best way to address concerns about money in politics is to require full disclosure of all political contributions and spending.
So more transparency, less regulation. What about the Federal Election Commission, or FEC?
Yeah.
That's the agency that enforces campaign finance laws.
They criticize the FEC, arguing that it's biased against conservatives and has been used to silence political opponents. They want to see the FEC reformed or even abolished, arguing that it's not necessary and that campaign finance laws can be enforced by the Department of Justice.
So a less powerful and more accountable FEC, or perhaps no FEC at all. Interesting. What about the Small Business Administration, or SBA? That's the agency that provides loans and other assistance to small businesses, which are often seen as the engine of the economy.
Well, they argue that the SBA has become too bureaucratic and that its programs are often ineffective.
Mm.
They believe that the best way to help small businesses is to reduce regulation and taxes,
right,
not to provide government assistance.
Okay.
They propose streamlining the SBA's loan programs, reducing the regulatory burden on small businesses,
right,
and eliminating or reforming SBA programs that they view as wasteful or ineffective.
So a leaner and more efficient SBA with a focus on creating a more favorable environment for small businesses rather than providing direct assistance that seems consistent with their overall philosophy of limited government.
It is, they believe that the private sector is better equipped to drive economic growth and create jobs, and that the government's role should be limited to creating a level playing field and removing obstacles to success.
Okay, so that's a comprehensive overview of their vision for government. It's ambitious, to say the least.
Mm-hmm.
They're essentially proposing to reshape every aspect of government according to their conservative philosophy.
It's certainly a bold vision. It would be a major departure from the current direction of government, and it would likely face significant opposition from Democrats and even some moderate Republicans. But it's clear that they're serious about their agenda and they're prepared to fight for it.
It's fascinating to see how they connect their ideas to broader themes like American exceptionalism and individual liberty. They really paint a picture of a very different America. One thing that stands out to me is how they consistently emphasize the importance of personnel. They clearly believe that putting the right people in the right positions is key to achieving their goals.
Yeah, they really hammer home that point, emphasizing the need for loyal appointees who are ideologically aligned with their vision. It's clear that they're not interested in incremental change. They want to completely transform the direction of government.
It's like a roadmap for a conservative revolution.
That's a good way to put it. It will be interesting to see how much of this agenda they're actually able to implement if a conservative president takes office in 2025.
Only time will tell, but this document gives us a valuable glimpse into their thinking and their priorities. It's a fascinating document for sure. It feels like they're laying the groundwork for a sweeping change in how the U.S. government operates. They're not just, you know, tweaking policies. They're aiming for a fundamental realignment of power and priorities.
And they do it all in a very matter-of-fact, almost clinical way. Like
Yeah.
they're saying, here's the plan, no need to panic, we've got this.
It's bold, but is it realistic? I mean, could they actually pull this off? What would a conservative-led America really look like in practice?
Yeah.
Based on this document.
Well, one thing that jumps out at me is the emphasis on decentralization.
Okay.
They want to shift power away from the federal government
Right.
and back to states, localities, and individuals. It's a vision of a smaller, less intrusive federal government with more decision-making happening closer to home.
It's interesting because on one hand, that sounds appealing.
Right.
Less bureaucracy, more local control.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, couldn't that lead to like a patchwork of different laws and policies
right.
across the country,
yeah,
making it harder for businesses to operate and for people to move from state to state?
That's definitely a potential concern. It raises questions about how we, you know, balance the
yeah.
need for national unity with the desire for local autonomy. It's a debate that's been going on
right.
since the founding of the country, and this document clearly leans towards the side of decentralization.
And it's not just about decentralization.
Right.
It's about shrinking the role of government overall. They seem to have a deep distrust of big government and a strong belief in the power of the free market.
Right. They see the private sector as the engine of economic growth and prosperity, and they believe that the government should get out of the way and let businesses do what they do best.
But what about those who are struggling? Those who need a safety net? This document doesn't seem to offer much in the way of support for the, you know, poor and vulnerable.
That's true. Their focus is very much on
yeah.
individual responsibility and self-reliance.
Right.
They believe that the best way to help people is to empower them to help themselves, not to
yeah.
create a culture of dependency on government assistance.
It's a philosophy that's sure to resonate with some, but it also raises concerns about, you know, fairness and equity.
Right.
Will everyone have an equal opportunity to succeed in this vision of America?
That's the question, isn't it? It's a debate that's likely to continue long after this document fades from the headlines.
So, mandate for leadership. It's a roadmap, a blueprint for potential future.
Mm.
It's packed with ideas that could have a, you know, real impact on your life.
Yeah.
Whether you're an entrepreneur, a parent, a teacher, or just someone who cares about
mm.
where America is headed.
It's a call to action, an invitation to engage in the debate
mm-hmm.
about what kind of country we want to be.
It's a reminder that ideas have consequences.
Yeah.
And that elections matter.
It's a challenge to think critically about the role of government in our lives.
Right.
And to decide what kind of future we want to build together.
Well, thanks for joining us on this deep dive into Mandate for Leadership. It's been a wild ride.
It certainly has. This document is thought-provoking, to say the least.
And it leaves us with a lot to ponder as we, you know, head into the future.
Until next time, keep diving.